The following program is brought to you by Podcast One Sportsnet.
All right, listen to the Steve Austin Show. Pay attention. I want to keep this podcast free to download with minimal ads. And to do so, I would appreciate your participation in a Podcast One survey. Either go to podcastone.com/my survey or visit Podcast One. That's podcastone.com and click on the survey banner. Thank you. This episode of the Steve Austin Show is sponsored in part by DDP Yoga. All right, you guys probably heard I did my very first DDPY workout with Dallas a couple of weeks ago. And I was really impressed by how much I liked the program and liked the workout. And I made a commitment to stick with the program for a couple of months, and I ain't backing down. I've been doing my regular workouts with the DDP Yoga Now app, and I can definitely feel a difference. If you don't believe me, just check out this list of folks DDP has helped with this program. Scott Hall, Goldust, Chris Jericho, Edge, Jake Roberts, AJ Styles, Drew McIntyre, Bobby Fish, Tony Schiavone, and Podcast One's own JL Sonnen. Listen, Dallas is so positive that you will absolutely love the DDPY program and using the DDPY app that he's doing something he ain't never done before. He's going to give you 7 days free to try it out. That's a week to try the program, explore the app, get to know it, get a feel for it, get a load of all the content, and own your life, and it's completely free. Listen, DDP Yoga can work for all ages, all weights, all fitness levels. It's a kick-ass cardio workout that will dramatically increase your flexibility and strengthen your core like never before, and this is all done with minimal joint impact. Just listen to the Steve Austin Show. You can save 20% off an annual membership for the DDP Yoga Now app, which now features DDPY Rebuild. Just go to ddpyoga.com/Austin to get started. Also, Dallas will be in Raleigh, North Carolina, July 23rd and July 24th for the Raleigh SuperCon. He'll be there signing autographs and taking pictures both days. And go ahead and start planning to attend the biggest DDPY workshop ever, happening September 1st at StarCast in Chicago, Illinois. Tickets for the workshop are on sale now. Get more details at ddpyogaworkshops.com.
The following program is a podcast1.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
All right, everybody, welcome to Steve Austin Show. I am coming to you from the mean streets of Los Angeles, California, on a bright, sunny day, June 27th, as I record to open this podcast. The year is 2018, and what a dynamo of a morning it has been for yours truly, Steve Austin. I'm about to play the podcast that I recorded with Big Leon White, Big Van Vader, a couple of years ago, and I figured I would re-release this podcast because I know that it was buried back in the archives. A lot of people don't have access to the archives. And a very good friend of mine said, "Hey, Steve, why don't you replay that conversation you had with Leon White? I enjoyed it. And I think your fans and your listeners and all the fans of Vader would enjoy it as well." And I said, "Man, that's a really good idea. I appreciate it." So I'm re-releasing the podcast that I conducted with Big Leon White a couple of years ago. He was an awesome force in the business of professional wrestling. He was a good friend of mine and many other people. Like I said last week, he gave me so much good advice, and I enjoyed watching so many of his matches. And the dude was just a big, bad, money-drawing force in the business of pro wrestling, and he was a sweetheart of a guy outside the ring. You wouldn't know by looking at him because he was so big and bad and just a mountain of a man, but he was a real softy at heart. And I think universally everybody just loved him, and I did, and I had a great time traveling with him the few times that I did. So I'm replaying that conversation. I think you'll enjoy it. This was a podcast from a couple of years ago, and I can't remember how the phone reception was. It might have went in and out a few times, but I think you'll enjoy this conversation. And obviously I won't be able to talk to Leon anymore. My condolences to all of his family. But this morning, to move to a different speed before we get to Big Leon White, Big Van Vader, I got a chance to talk with one of my good friends, Lillian Garcia, formerly of WWE, just like myself. She is one of the hardest working people in the podcast business, and her new podcast is back. Chasing Glory, coming back Monday, July 2nd, and yours truly, me, Stone Cold Steve Austin, as their first guest. Actually, I only go as Steve Austin, but I thought I'd throw that in there for a little pizzazz. Anyway, Chasing Glory is coming back Monday, July 2nd. I'm her first guest. She's got a bunch of really cool people lined up. I'm not going to drop their names. I'll let her do that. And you can find her new podcast on Apple Podcasts and everywhere podcasts are found. And if you go to Lillian's website, LillianGarcia.com, you will find all the links to her new show, Chasing Glory. It's coming back, so check it out. And like I said, I'm the first guest, July 2nd. She's got a bunch of really cool people after me, And I always love talking to Lillian because first and foremost, she's a very good friend and she works her ass off. She puts in the work. She does the research. She takes notes and she's always very, very prepped, prepared, and just cool. And if you ever talk to Lillian, she's so easy to talk to and she's so warm. And we've been good friends a long time. So bottom line is, I always love talking to Lillian Garcia, and I'm happy for her success and the fact that she's bringing her show back, and I wish her all the luck in the world. And please check out the first episode that comes back July 2nd with myself, Steve Austin, talking with the one and only Lillian Garcia, and that's the bottom line. Before we get to Leon White, let's take care of some business. They say soccer is the football of the rest of the world. Only soccer's championship lasts an entire month, and there's no better place to spend that month than at Buffalo Wild Wings. Get into B-Dubs, where they've got match day select domestic beer specials and a special sauce mashup to go along with their already loaded roster of 21 sauces and seasonings. That's enough combinations for a full month's worth of delicious cheering. Catch all the soccer action at Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports. Offers vary by location.
Shut it down!
Hi, I'm John Taffer. You probably know me because I've rescued thousands of bars, hundreds of them on TV.
That's your future broken!
I'm also a best-selling author, and I've owned and operated a bunch of other businesses. But now, I'm here on Podcast One with my new show, No Excuses.
I only yell at assholes.
Every Tuesday, I'm going to give it to you straight. I'm giving you all things bar rescue, insider peeks of what's going on the set, current events and topics you care about, with in-your-face analysis, and you know how straight I can be. And I'm going to have unforgettable guest interviews with the world's most interesting people, and I'm going to ask them the questions that nobody else has ever asked them. And yes, sometimes I can be a bit of an ass, but I'm going to shut it down every Tuesday and make no excuses. It's going to be the number one show here on Podcast One. Listen to it every Tuesday on PodcastOne.com, on the Podcast One app, and on Apple Podcasts. And remember, rate and review it, or I'm going to shut you down.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
Before Vader, because before he was Vader, he started off in the AWA. Leon, okay, ex-football player. You watched the business a little bit. You dug it. So how do you end up getting in the business?
You know what, buddy? After the Los Angeles Rams, I just got bored. I went back to Boulder and got my real estate license and started selling real estate and doing a little speculating and building a house here and selling the house. And I got bored out of my mind. I got tired of talking to women that wanted this color of curtain and this color of tile. And my goodness, I was about ready to have a fit. And I went down to the local wrestling show down in Denver, and they had a card on there. I mean, Bruiser Brody was on it, Stan Hansen, Jerry Blackwell, Kurt Hennig, Big Scott Hall, down in Denver, Colorado, at that old Denver Coliseum, and it held 8,800 people, and boy, it was jam-packed. And that was exciting, I'll tell you what. And I put on a pair of cowboy boots and a cowboy hat, and I had now ballooned up to, 400 plus pounds, and I was in the gym. And buddy, I could bench press 600 pounds. I could squat 1,000. And my claim to fame, man, is I could take 365 pounds behind my neck and jump press that weight 12, 15 times in a rep. And I used to stop the gym. I mean, I don't care where I was, if I was in Venice Beach, California, that just everyone stopped and looked because there was no one in the gym that could do that. Not that many reps. And that was just my thing. I don't know why I was good at it. I was good at that overhead press, and they said, that's a big dude, and that's a lot of weight to be jerking over your head. So I was bigger than a horse, man, and gained a bunch of weight purposely for this meeting. I thought, hey, the bigger the better, right? Because you're watching these guys on TV and you're thinking they're all 6'8 and all 400 pounds, and TV put size on people. And I walked in there and really saw the size of people and said, damn, I gained all this weight for nothing. So, but I remember I didn't knock on the door, Steve, and I just walked in and everybody just froze. And a guy named Bruiser Brody stood up, walked over, and I had my boots on. And Brody was about 6'5", and he had his boots on. And so we were about eye to eye. He was a little taller than me, but I had a big boot on. So he said, "What the f*** you want in my locker room?" And I said, "I'm here to get a job. That's what I'm here for." And I stared him right back in the eye. And Brody, you know, Brody was just no one to mess with, period. And we all know that. And may he rest in peace. But he turned out to be a pretty good friend of mine. And we had some places matches together. But Greg Gagne was there, and a guy named Brad Riggins was there. And they come rushing over. And Kurt Hennig, they came rushing over. And said, "Hey, man, you can't be in here." And I said, "Wait a minute, man. This is who I am." And, you know, I live right down the road, and I played football at the University of Colorado, and I played for the Los Angeles Rams, and I had my Super Bowl ring on, and, you know, I was ready.
Right.
And Gene Reed, the promoter, and then may he rest in peace, he said, "Yeah, I know who Leon is. We need to talk to this guy." And he calmed everyone down, so Brody went and sat down.
Hey, let me jump in here real quick, Leon, because first of all, to all my fans out there, I'm sure you can assume that the professional wrestling dressing room is super kayfabe. Now, if you go way back about 25 years or 30 years when Leon's talking about he first walks into this dressing room, you're talking about triple kayfabe. I mean, dude, you just walked in a badass area where the business was protected, and if you were just some unbeknownst fan just thinking you're going to walk in on a meeting or what the boys are doing, it's a good way to get your ass handed to you. So it was absolutely crazy. So what possessed you to even just get the idea to go in there and say, "Hey, I want a job"?
Like, Steve, like I said, I was going crazy selling real estate.
you must have been.
Out of my mind. And like I said, I got a pair of jeans on and a tight T-shirt, and I was 415 pounds, and I just said, "You know what, I'm going to do it." And I stood by that door. I stood outside that door for for an hour. Probably at least an hour before I had the guts just to push it open or open it up and walk in.
So what happens? What are you thinking when Brody comes up to you face to face and you've only seen him as a fan sitting in a chair? He's in the ring doing his thing. And of course, Brody's one of my favorite all time. And he had that look and that intimidating presence, that the size. And again, you're a big man, but you're talking about Bruiser Brody, the guy you've been seeing on TV. So, I mean, when he comes walking up to you, what are you thinking?
You know what? I about shit my pants.
Yeah.
But not straight up. I was scared to death, but I wasn't going to show it.
Yep.
And I stared him right down in the eye and said, "Man, I'm here to get a job." And, buddy, I was scared to death. My knees were shaking. My hands were shaking. And I was scared to death because, like I said, you watch wrestling on TV, especially back in those days, and you know, you thought these guys weren't just tough. They were crazy and tough. And so it took a lot of nerve to do that, but things calmed down real quick, Steve. And Brad said, "Listen, let me get a pen and paper before something happens." And Brad Riggins he wrote down his name and number. He says, "You're serious, call me." And Greg Gagne says, "Well, we appreciate you coming in." And Gene Reed had come over and shook my hand and said, "No, this is Leon White. He was, you know, we had an appointment. I didn't think we'd meet in the locker room like this." And Gene was getting old, but Gene calmed everyone down. And next thing I know, man, I got my bags packed, and I'm in my car on my way to Minnesota. And, you know, but Brad Riggins, what a trainer, what a career he's had, because he's put out some big, big names, you know. I can't name them all, but.
Yeah, no, he's trained a lot of great guys. So, but what was training camp like for you? Because you always hear the standard, okay, we're going to do Hindu squats and push-ups, or it's all conditioning. What was Brad's methodology? I mean, was it learning how to take a bump? Brad obviously is known for his Olympic-level wrestling, great amateur background. So what was his protocol to teach you, who would go on to become Big Van Vader? But right now, you're still Leon White.
Well, buddy, he broke us into groups, and, you know, there were some kids there that, you know, maybe didn't possess the athleticism, and he knew what he was doing. He was really good at what he did. And we started off with a 2-mile run, and at 415 pounds, that, you know, that was it for me. I'd finished that 2-mile run, and it was like it was time for me to go back to the hotel, and in reality, it was just the beginning.
Right.
And then we got started for a 3-hour workout, and, you know, we started out with the basics and locking up, and Brad, he liked to shoot with us. He, you know, he wanted to see what you were made of. And he said, "Do you have any wrestling skills?" And, you know, I said, you know, "No." But, I, you know, Brad is, you know, if you look at him, he's what, 5'8" or 9? And, you know, you say, well, heck, I could handle this guy. But the bottom line is, I mean, this guy is built like a fire hydrant, built like a Coke machine, and stronger. Back in this particular point in time, you know, he was training for the 1980 Olympics, and then Carter pulled the United States out of it, which cost Brad millions of dollars and probably that gold medal, because he was the odds-on favorite to win the gold.
Right.
And this guy wasn't just tough. He was super tough. He might have 5'8", 5'9". He might have not looked like Superman, you know, standing there in front of you. And, you know, here I am at 6'4". Legit, you know, according to that NFL tape, and 400 plus pounds, and Vince throwing all this weight around, and I said, well, heck, I just walked up and stood in front of him, and he said, pair up, so I just walked over to him and thought, well, heck, I'll just throw him around and show him what's up.
Show Brad Riggins what's up. Keep going, this is great.
Well, Brad Riggins, he was, I mean, you talk about a wrestling fanatic. He had a big, nice house, 4 or 5-bedroom home, and he had a enclosed, because we're talking about Minnesota, enclosed pool, jacuzzi, everything. And, you know, he filled it up with dirt and cement and just poured that pool over the cement so he could start his wrestling school. And I always thought, what a shame to cover up that beautiful pool and that beautiful jacuzzi. But he did leave this little portable. It was a toilet. And what he had done is he'd built a little square around the toilet so that, you know, you didn't have to go in his house. His wrestlers didn't have to go in his house to use his restroom.
Right.
And boy, you know, we locked up and we started moving. And, you know, I had good feet work. And I was kind of pass blocking him and really didn't know what I was doing. And we got rougher and rougher and rougher and rougher and rougher. And the next thing I know, man, I am inside of this bathroom. He put my head, Steve, right through that door. I mean, knocked it off its hinges, cracked it. My head's bleeding. And I'm on all fours, and my face is staring down in the toilet. You know what I'm saying? He got to the side of me, grabbed the back of my head, and just ran it right into that door. And... Well, I tell you what, you talk about an attitude adjustment, buddy. I got up out of that. I got up and I was madder than hell, and I kicked that door, and that door went flying. And I went over and got in line and said, "Yes, sir. What's next?" And buddy, it just amazed me. I mean, this little guy just took me and handled me like a rag doll. And
that might be one of the greatest stories I've ever heard in my life. Yes, sir. But, what's next? And you was going to go over there and show Brad Riggins what's up. That is unbelievable.
And he manhandled me. I mean, I put up a pretty good tussle and for about 10 seconds, I think. And buddy, he was just playing with me, getting his feet in position, got to the side of me, and just ran my head right through that door. I mean, blood and busted that door off both its hinges, cracked it, and flipped it over. And in other words, the door's on my back, and I'm on all fours, and I'm staring in the toilet. And the bad thing about it was the guy before me had not flushed the toilet. So, and you know what? I was at the 1,000th episode of Raw, and Vince and Hunter was good enough to bring me back for that. Brock Lesnar, and I had never met the gentleman. And, you know, Brock is a beast, and he had been trained by Brad Riggins. And Brock was kind of looking at me, and I got up, and I went over and shook his hand and said, "Man, it's my honor to meet you." And we started talking about Brad, and boy, I brought up this story, and he just started laughing. He said, "Leon, that's the funniest thing I've ever heard." He said, "Well, you got to give yourself credit. You tried." And I said, "Yeah, I didn't try very long, buddy." But
hey, what other kind of were there any other guys that were in a class with you that ended up making it in the business or making it big time?
Buddy, you know, Rob Steiner was down there, and he had already went through a school, but he was. I think he was hanging on. He was hanging around Minnesota trying to get on with the AWA, so he was coming to the class, and you know he was kind of helping out Brad. You know, he was a student, but he was an experienced student.
Now, what was your thoughts early on Steiner? Because man, that dude, you talk about compact, dense, muscular, and super strong, and a good shooter. What was your impressions of Rick Steiner early on?
Well, it was Rob, not Rick, and.
Well, I know it was Rob, but he would change his name to Rick because their name was Rob Rick Steiner, but it was Rick Steiner. So anyway, so Rob Steiner.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you just think about that story I just told you, and Rob Rick was a heck of a college wrestler too. He was an All-American. He didn't go as far as Brad did. So I kind of had a newfound respect for anybody that was a wrestler, whether it was high school, college, or especially the Olympics. And he was a nice guy, and he was very helpful, very instructive. And, you know, we got along good, but it you know what? All the cockiness in me was gone, and I was there to learn and work hard. But what a physical specimen. My God, back in that day, just like you said, compact, strong, quick, just.
I remember seeing him. I guess the first time I started seeing Rick Steiner, I think he was still going as Rob Rick Steiner back then in Power Pro Mid-South. I think he was working for Bill Watts. And I saw this guy, and I was like, Jesus Christ. 5'11", maybe, and maybe 250, but I mean, the most dense 250 pounds and strong as hell. You could just see what he was doing on television, but just totally impressive. So you guys are there at the school. How much training did Brad put you through before you got into your first match inside the squared circle?
Well, you know what? A lot of what Brad did, you know, first thing he wanted to do is see if you had what it took, and it was all about the physicality. In other words, when we wrestled, we shot. It was just conditioning. You know, he'd do squats, he'd run you, he'd put you on the bike, we'd hit the ropes, we'd do push-ups, if it was that type of thing. And if you got through, if you survived that, and then he started teaching wrestling. But he wasn't going to waste his time and teach everyone. Like you said, it wasn't just kayfabe back then. It was triple kayfabe.
Right.
So he wasn't going to give up the business till he thought you were going to make it.
Right.
And, you know, you get a class of 15, 20 kids, and, you know, that would dwindle down to 4 or 5 pretty quick. And, you know, I'm sure Brad got his money up front, so it didn't matter. He narrowed it down, and I made that cut, and, I wasn't going nowhere. And then we started coaching, and he started coaching wrestling and psychology. And like I said, I can't say enough about Brad Riggins and his ability to coach. And, you know, I know Pert Henning was trained by him, Rick Rude, Scott Hall was there. You remember a guy named Berserker? He kind of had a gimmick like Brody.
Yeah.
Okay, he was down there. I mean, it just, the list just goes on and on about who Brad Riggins has trained. You know, Brock Lesnar and on and on and on. But I went over there, and I remember Brad said, you know, had told Vern Gagne. So Vern Gagne and Greg Gagne actually came over to the camp, and we put on a little show for him. I gave him a little 5-minute match and was pressing people over my head and suplexing and moving and hitting the ropes. And, you know, they said, well, how much do you weigh? And I said, well, I'm about 420 now. I've lost some weight since I got here, you know, doing a couple things off the top rope. And, you know, so they were impressed. And you know, I remember Vern shaking Brad's hand saying, good job. You know, we can use this guy. And AWA was running strong, and they had one heck of a talent roster, Steve. I mean, they had Michael Hayes and the Freebirds. They had Shawn Michaels, Shawn and Michael. They had Kurt Hennig, Scott Hall, Stan Hansen, Bruiser Brody. I mean, that list just kept going on and on of the talent that they had there to AWA at the time, and they were doing pretty good business. And that was back when we had the regional territories. You know, New York had their territory, and the AWA had their territory, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, so they were probably doing 20, 25 days a month, and I was getting about half of those and was happy to get it. But,
well, man, when you mentioned those names, Leon, I mean, just as far as a couple of them, you said a hell of a group of names there, a lot of Hall of Famers, but with the Road Warriors and then, you know, Bam Bam, part of the Freebirds, Hanson and Brody there. Man, that's a hell of a damn roster. So who were you working with in your first matches in the AWA?
The Kurt Hennig's Hall of Famer, Scott Hall's Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
Stan Hansen and Bruiser Brody and Jerry Blackwell.
Yeah.
I mean, Jerry was, I mean, he was 5'10", you know, and big guy, but he was 400 and, God, you know, nearly 500 pounds, and that guy could drop kick. So, I mean, that was a, for me, it was a great place to watch, because there wasn't, once I got out of that camp, it was kind of like, you know, hey, this guy is not just strong, he's real strong, and he's real dangerous because he's green and he wants to do well. So first thing they did was stick me with Bruiser Brody. And, you know, it wasn't about, well, hey, I'm going to you know, teach you some psychology. But Bruiser Brody just beat the hell out of me for 3 months. And I was black and blue. And you want a Bruiser Brody story?
Yeah.
Okay. We're in Milwaukee, and there wasn't a whole lot of people. And Brody was barking around the ring, and I'm standing there looking stupid. And the referee standing, he's barking and doing circles. And he walks over and says, kid, just relax. Stay right here. I'll be back. And we were in that Green Bay, Wisconsin indoor auditorium, and it must have held 50,000 people. Brody's barking around all the people and then took off and went all the way to the top of that stadium and was doing bark. And somehow worked his way back down, got back in the ring, walked over to me, and I'm standing there like an idiot. The bell ain't been ringed. And booted me in the mouth. And let me tell you what, it was not a working boot. I took the hit on the back, and he had a chair in his hand. And the chair obviously had Milwaukee Chair Company on that chair, okay? And it was engraved in that chair. And he hit me in the back right in front of the referee because his intent was to get disqualified, and that was it. He didn't like something. He was upset about something because I remember Nick Bockwinkel was the booker. And him and Nick had some words before the match. Maybe it's because he had to work with me, you know, because I was just greener than green. I don't know. But he booted me in the face. I went down. I got up. He took that chair and hit me in the back. Steve, I've never been hit so hard in my life, and I'm talking about throughout. You know, as a rookie with the Los Angeles Rams, you remember a guy named Hacksaw
yeah.
Reynolds?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Hacksaw was just a man. I mean, he was 6'2" and 275 pounds, and boy, he got right in front of me, and he came in on a blitz and a pass, and he hit me right under the chin and knocked me out cold. And I thought that I'll never get hit harder than that in my life. And Bruiser Brody hit me with that chair, and it literally knocked me out. I went down to my face, and I was laying there in the ring, and I couldn't move. I opened my eyes. And I actually took my fingers and to make sure they were open, and I still couldn't see. All I saw was black. And I went into the locker room, and Kurt Penning, who was the, you know, just in my book was one of the all time great individuals. Just funny, fun to be around. I drove with him and Scott. Scott and I had developed a friendship back then, and Kurt Henning, and Scott came over and said, "Let me see your back." And he starts laughing, and he got everyone around there. And on my back was imprinted the Milwaukee Chair Company. And he had hit me so hard that the lettering had made an impression on my back. And you literally could read it. So, buddy, I'll tell you what, I've never been hit harder than that in my life. And so from Bruiser Brody, I went to Stan Hansen. And, you know, that wasn't much better. And then I finally got to Jerry Blackwell, and he had a softer side to him. He was a big, tough guy, don't get me wrong, but you know, he started teaching me a little bit, and from there I started learning, and, you know, my master started improving. And
well, let's go back to the Bruiser Brody story when he shellacked with the chair after the big boot to the gourd. Usually okay. There's a little conversation that happens after the goings on in a match. Did you say, hey, what's up, or shake hands, or say, are you just going about your business? Because obviously, you went out there thinking you was going to work a match, and not so much.
Well, no, he came up to me. He came up to me and stuck his hand out and said, "Leon, that wasn't about you. I apologize. I hope you're all right." I mean, he wasn't apologetic, but he explained it, that there's some things going on. And you know what? I was in no position. I mean, again, this was Bruiser Brody. He was, you know, making big money over in Japan and really was doing this part-time for Vern Gagne on his days off from Japan. But he had a full schedule with Baba, as did Stan. So Stan and Brody would come together. And, you know, Stan Hansen in his prime and Bruiser Brody in his prime, let me tell you what, there was two mean cats. I mean, they could get in the ring and flat get the job done. And I can't say it without cussing, so I'm going to let it go.
Go ahead.
They could get it done. Oh, they could fight or climb a tree, let me tell you what. Bruiser Brody in his prime, 6'5", 340 pounds, and no fat on him. And, you know, he was in shape. You know, he didn't drink. He didn't, you know. And Stan, the same way. Stan was, you know, wasn't quite as tall as Brody, but about 340. And let me tell you what, man, that was a tough job.
Now, how was the early matches with Stan Hansen? Because in a little bit, we'll get to the some of your famous matches in Japan with Stan Hansen with the eye incident. But how was Stan Hansen early on? You're the green guy in the business. Here's Stan Hansen several years ahead of you, a veteran and a tough one with a big name. So how were those matches with Hansen in the early days?
You know, I've never had a match quite like the one I had with Brody, but you know what? Stan basically said, you know, his attitude is, so you want to be a wrestler. You know, you're a big football star and you're a big kid. And, you know, he heard all the stories about how much weight I was throwing around in the gym. And, you know, it's kind of like marking your territory. And he did that. I mean, you know, I've taken that clothesline and just flipped me end over end, all 400 pounds of me. And I've taken his big boot. And it was kind of a process with me. I felt in my mind that there was dues to be paid, and then, you know, you had to take what they were given and keep your mouth shut and get back in the next day to a degree and for a period of time. And that's what happened with me. It's like, you know, I took it. I felt I paid my dues. And then there came a time and a point where it just all of a sudden, yeah, you know what? I am 400 pounds and I can bench for 600. And you know what? I don't think you could do this if I don't let you do it.
Right.
In other words, there was a definite respect. In other words, I paid my dues. I gave my respect and I learned. And once I got to the point where I felt I was competent in the ring to have a match, then I started demanding to be given one. And if it didn't happen, well, then you would you'd have to prove it.
Yeah. But that's the process. Yeah. Go and pay your dues. You're going to take some shellackings as part of that process. And along with that paying the dues comes the learning curve. And then all of a sudden, you start equaling things out, and it's like, okay, now here's what the story is. All due respect, yeah, I know who you are, but this is who I'm turning into right now. So, who came up with that? What'd you start off with there, Leon? Were you the baby bull then, or bull power?
I started off actually in college as the baby bull. There was a senior All-American lineman at the University of Colorado. He just called me the baby bull, and then as I got to be a sophomore and a junior and a senior, it went from the baby bull to bull power, and then my senior year, you know, they just called me the bull. And so I naturally took that nickname from college football and thought, hey, the bull power, and I got some leather straps around my wrists and shaved my head and put, you know, I was going bald anyways up top, so I, you know, got those horns and, you know, kind of took that idea off the Road Warriors a little bit and just tried to come up with something. And so I was started out in the AWA as the bull power, or just the bull.
Okay,
and,
so the Road Warriors are there. That when they saw you do the haircut gimmick, were they saying, hey, this is gimmick infringement, or were they cool with what you were doing?
They didn't say a word, buddy. I mean, you know, they were, you know, the Road Warriors were number one tag team in the world for a long, long time.
Yep.
And they were making a ton of money, and you know, I always got along with Animal and Hawk, so they never said anything. And you know what, my hair was so light, and Hawk was pretty similar to mine, and then Joe's was different, but I remember having a conversation with Hawk. I said, you know, with the way my hair is receding and getting thin, I really don't have anything else to do other than shave it. And I tried that, and that didn't look good. So I grew the horns back, and they were fine with it. They were, you know, again, they were making a ton of money on the gimmick sales, the merchandise, and they were getting paid a lot of money. And, you know, it didn't affect them, and it just wasn't a problem for them, you know.
Did you see Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty were there as the Rockers, Midnight Rockers? Did you see greatness on those kids at an early age, or did you just think there was a couple of pain in the ass guys who were pretty athletic and all the girls liked them?
Well, you know what? That was the case. They were a pain in the ass, and they did have the girls. Let me tell you what, Shawn and Marty had the, you know, they had a following of little girls, just, you know, little 15, 16, 17, 18-year-old women just go from town to town, and big crowds came. They were talented, though. And I'm, you know, specifically Shawn. He had been in the business at that time less than a year, and, you know, he could have a great match in the sleep. And he had the long hair back then, and, you know, he had the blonde hair, blue-eyed, pretty boy. And then, buddy, let me tell you what, he could flat go You know, it was impressive to see Sean at that early age. You know, it was just natural for him. Marty obviously was, you know, the second part of that tag team, and was very good at himself. And, you know, he looked good and was tan. But I'll tell you what, it was impressive to watch him. You know, and then again, that whole crew was Hall of Fame. Kurt Hennig's in the Hall of Fame.
Oh, I know. I know what you thought about Kurt. I know you struck up a friendship with Scott, and he just got into the Hall of Fame. And, of course, I followed Scott from way back. And, man, a very, very talented guy. But what were your early impressions of the Freebirds?
Michael Hayes was to me, you know, he was the kind of the leader of that group. And, of course, you had Bam Bam, who was a big, talented man. The third part of that group, I forget his name, and I apologize. I'm sure you'll
know. Buddy Roberts.
Yeah, okay. To me, they, you know what, of all the talent that was there, to me, the Freebirds was the best act on the show. I mean, I'm talking about from the point, and especially Michael Hayes, from the point of walking out the curtain and getting in that ring and putting on a show. And we're talking about tag team specialists. They always work six men. And man, I'll tell you what, I was a mark watching these guys work. And Bam Bam was what? He was right around 300 pounds, and
yeah,
probably, I don't know, 6'3" or 6'4". And Buddy, he could move. He could flat get it, and he'd hit those ropes and move. And they had their act down from Japan. And
did you work south with Gordy any over in Japan later on?
No, I never hooked up with him. I was with Inoki, and he was with Baba.
Right.
Him and Dr. Death hooked up quite a bit. But for the era, they were ahead of their time. Not only work in the ring, but the whole thing, the music, the hair, the look. And everybody else was kind of a step behind. But, I mean, of all that talent there, you know, and you talk about Bruiser Brody and Stan. We've been through this list. I thought the best of the best of that group in that era were the Freebirds.
Mister,
they had it all.
When they came to Dallas, I was playing football at North Texas State University. I used to drive up to the Sportatorium and drink beer to watch the Von Erichs fight the Freebirds. And that damn Michael Hayes used to piss me off to no ends, which he was doing his job. And he's one of my favorites of all time. And he talked trash all day long. And then they backed it up in the ring, and he was a heat-seeking missile on the microphone. And then you had Big Gordy in there laying the heat down, and Buddy Roberts was that guy that everybody thought they could kick his ass if they just got their hands on him. And it was just pandemonium there in the Sportatorium. So I was a big fan of the Freebirds. Surprise, they're not in the Hall of Fame yet. But
talking about the Hall of Fame, they've got the Four Horsemen in there, right? So they have the ability to put a group of people in, like a tag team. And I know Michael is, Mr. Hayes is associated with the WWE. I believe he worked for him. And I don't know why that hadn't happened, because the Fabulous Freebirds are, wow, they were ahead. They were 20 years ahead of their time and could flat entertain, put on a show. And, you know, probably of the three, Bam Bam was probably the best worker.
Yes.
But it wasn't about individual work. It was about that team effort and the show. The bottom line was entertainment, and they flat got its job done. But I was really impressed with Michael and the look. And like you said, he could get it on the mic. But you know,
how was Vern to work for as a promoter?
Well, my mom always told me, if you don't got nothing good to say, you probably shouldn't say it. But he paid good money.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you were on the show and he did well, you know, I thought he was fair, especially to me just starting out. Greg Gagne was actually running the show, and Vern kind of took a back seat. And there was a gentleman by the name of Big Otto Vance that had actually had the world title. I mean, we're talking going back now. This was one generation of AWA talent, and then you went back to Andre and Hulk Hogan and that group with the AWA, and then they all migrated up north, up to Vince McMahon and the WWF at that time. And then he refilled it again with this new group. And you know what, I haven't mentioned the Road Warriors. They were part of this group too. But he turned me on to Big Otto Vance, and I jumped at the chance. I mean, I looked at that roster and said, well, I believe in myself, and I believe I could crack that roster and become a main eventer there at TWA. But, you know, I like the idea of going drinking some cold beer and getting over Europe and starting out fresh and getting another style under my belt. So I took that offer. Big Otto made me an offer to come over there and offered me guaranteed money. And while I was gone and while I was over there in Austria and boy, it was beautiful, beautiful time in my life, and you know, had a lot of fun.
So coming out of AWA, you'd been there roughly 2 years, and so you were coming along pretty good as a hand in the ring.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. And then you get the call. Otto Vons wants you to come down there to the CWA, and you say, "Hey, man, this is going to be a good move for you." Vern also felt this was a good move for you to get a little bit more learning and get a little bit more experience.
Well, the way it was put to me was, Leon, you know, hey, look at the talent we got in front of you, and we believe that you could become something special. But you know, there's a long list here, and you know, again, you're talking about the Road Warriors, the Fabulous Freebirds, and you know, just to be on that lineup,
yeah,
to get on that card was something else. The Road Warriors, the Freebirds, you know, Jerry Blackwell, Stan Hansen, Bruiser Brody, Kurt Hennings,
well,
Shawn Michaels.
Everything you're mentioning is the main event match. So where were you on the card?
You know, I was going to save this for a little bit later, but myself and Scott Hall and Greg Gagne, you know, they were playing up the Ram thing, you know, a lot, real big, and they would tag us up, and I would get into the main event in that aspect. And we fought Larry Sabisco and Masa Saito and another big Japanese kid, and that's how Masa Saito worked with me. And Masa had Ken Patera and himself had gotten into a little trouble. I don't want to get into it.
Right.
But they spent a little time in the Huskow, and they got out. And Masa, you know, he was in – tell you what, he was eating in prison because he came out of prison. He was about 300 pounds and muscled up. He was in that gym every day. he's just, you know, Masa wasn't but about 5'9 and 300 pounds and was just
thick.
Solid as your wall you're sitting next
yeah.
to. I mean, he was just rock hard, scary looking dude. And we got in there and, you know, he saw me move and lock up, and I grabbed him, snatched him over my head and pressed him a couple times. And this was really basically, I had wrestled him. I was working full-time for Otto and had come back for Christmas and did a couple shots for Vern. And I happened to go to, it was in Las Vegas, and there was a TV match. And so Inoki, Masa Saito was then working for Inoki and said, hey, we got to get this guy. I mean, I guess they had tried to give the Ultimate Warrior the Vader gimmick and offered him the helmet and offered him the spot.
So they had the Vader gimmick already established. They were looking for the right person to put the Vader gimmick on. And we're talking about Antonio Inoki and New Japan, and Masa Saito is basically scouting you.
Well, yes, sir. That's right. And what they had done is they offered it to the Warrior and then brought him over and got him in some matches. And the thing about, in my opinion, in all of wrestling, but specifically in Japan, Steve, athleticism plays a big part. These Japanese wrestlers are as good as any wrestlers are wrestling in the world, and maybe better. The discipline standpoint, their matches are longer, they're entertaining, their finishes are intricate.
And technicality, yes.
But it's based on athleticism. And the Ultimate Warrior, I mean, he looked fantastic, but maybe it was a little bit awkward at times. Didn't have... You know, these Japanese guys are doing intricate moves and spots. And
man,
so,
going back to the day, let me jump in here, Leon. Going back to the day, and of course, Ultimate Warrior just went to the Hall of Fame. Unfortunately, just passed away. I used to pay my money to go see him down there in Dallas, Texas as a Dingo Warrior. But that gimmick, with his work style, with his work rate, not so much.
Well, not over there.
Not over there.
Yeah, these guys were all these guys. You start with Inoki to Choshu and Chono and Muta and Mizawa. These guys weren't just good wrestlers, and you're talking about, you know, they lived, eat, and breathed it. I mean, they had dojo set up and they had sleeping bags. They slept on the floor of the, you know, the ring was right there, and you'd have 30 guys sleeping around the ring. They'd wake up and fold up their sleeping bags and go to work. And
hey, let's
so
talk about
guys,
that a little bit, Leon. I mean, you know, the young boys down there, as we used to call them back in, I don't know if they still call them that, but, I mean, the guys coming through the camp, the guys that were training on their way up, you talk about paying some dues, mister. Now, and you paid your dues, and I certainly paid mine, and the system changed a lot. But, man, those guys, they start off at such a young age and are so regimented in their training and the repetition and shoot-style training. I mean, you can't help but be technically good and have a vast amount of respect for the business, because man, you're scrubbing floors to doing everything else to pay your dues to get your foot in the door.
Yes, sir. Cleaning toilets and scrubbing floors, cooking dinner, going shopping, washing clothes. I mean, it's A to Z over there. Anyway, you know what? May the warrior rest in peace, and my prayers go out to his family, his wife, and two beautiful daughters. But that gimmick just didn't work out for him. And so that match that I had in Vegas with Masa when I was in Europe, next thing I know, Noki had sent over a guy named Masao Hattori, who was a referee. He came over there, and, you know, Otto welcomed him with open hands. I believe we were in Hanover, and I was in a match. And next thing I know, you know, I got an offer from him to go over full time and work for Noki. And, you know, it wasn't just more money. It was substantially more money. And Big Otto, he got pretty mad and had a few words with Hattori and said, you know, I treated you like a gentleman, and you're over here trying to steal my top hand. Because I was Otto's world champion at the time. And
right.
It was a hard situation for me because I love Big Otto and I loved Europe. But, you know, I'm a young man and trying to buy a house for my family and feed my kid. And so it was a situation where, you know, I just couldn't say no. So I was off to Japan.
All right, let's take a quick pause for the calls and give big ups to Geico. Go to geico.com, and in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. That's right. Save hundreds of dollars on car insurance at geico.com. Extra money in your pocket? It may just be the most rewarding thing you do today. Speaking of rewarding, why don't you reward your body with freedom from muscle cramps? If you're one of the millions of Americans who suffers from muscle cramps in your legs and feet, Relief is finally in sight. TheraWorks Relief is a topical foam. It's clinically proven to relieve muscle cramps fast, and with daily use, TheraWorks Relief can even prevent muscle cramps before they start. Finally, you'll be able to get a good night's sleep and do all the activities that you love and not worry about muscle cramps. TheraWorks Relief is a life-changing product, and best of all, you don't need a prescription. It only takes minutes to apply, absorbs quickly, and it really works. It's time you made it yours as well. Get TheraWorks Relief today at select CVS, Rite Aid, and Walgreens pharmacies, or at TheraWorksRelief.com. That's TheraWorksRelief.com. All right, listen to the Steve Austin Show. I got something for you. I want to keep this podcast free to download with minimal ads. And to do so, I would appreciate your participation in a Podcast One survey. The responses will help make sure that the right advertisers are matched up with you folks, the audience. The survey is short and will take no more than 5 minutes of your day. Either go to podcastone.com/mysurvey or visit Podcast One, that's podcastone.com, and click on the survey banner. This survey will go a long way in making the Steve Austin Show a lot better than it already is. And that's the bottom line, because I said so. Thank you. All right, let me ask you guys a question. Is your home an ADT home? Because mine is, and yours should be too. Get ADT and help protect against break-ins, fire, and carbon monoxide. For a limited time, take advantage of ADT's lowest rate starting at just $28.99 a month from the most trusted name in home security. Plus, ADT is the first security company to help keep you safe at home and when you're on the go with their ADT Go app, which features a family locator, safe driving reports, and even includes SOS button with 24/7 emergency response. And the best part is that you get ADT Go with the purchase of any security system. Just go to ADT.com/podcast to take advantage of ADT's lowest rate. 36-month monitoring contract required. Early termination and installation fees apply. Excludes taxes and fees. Applies to traditional services only. Certain markets excluded. Licenses available at ADT.com.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
We're in Japan now, and we're in that room. Inoki, Saito, telling you to get over at New Japan Pro Wrestling. So, how does Big Van Vader make his debut? How did the Big Van Vader gimmick get presented to you? Whose idea was it?
Again, Masa Saito had, and we go back to the AWA, Masa Saito, Inoki had created this gimmick, and it was based on a cartoon character. And I understand there was some folklore about Vader. There was a 5th century samurai warrior that, you know, back in that day, how the Japanese settled disputes was, you know, the toughest guy from each village would roll out to a little island, and they'd fight until someone died. And the guy that came back, you know, that was it. The whole village just didn't fight. It was just, you know, hey, you're the toughest guy, go out there and fight. Whoever comes back, that's the deal. And Vader was apparently he went out to an island with this other top guy from another village, and they fought 72 hours and died at each other's feet. And there was a cartoon character based on that named Vader, and Anoki created this character and made this helmet. And I believe Sid Vicious was considered for the spot, as was the Ultimate Warrior. And they brought Masao Hattori over to Europe with Big Otto Vance when I was over there working for him, and looked at me and made me the offer for the spot. But the debut for me was in the Tokyo Dome, and you have to remember, Antonio Inoki, Steve, he hadn't been beat in almost 8 years. He had an undefeated streak for 8 years, and he was, you know, you talk about Hulk Hogan and Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Rock and, you know, all the great big names in America. You imagine going undefeated for almost a decade. So imagine the popularity he had at this time when I stepped in the ring with him at a sold-out Sumo Palace. And I beat him in about 4 minutes. And, you know, getting back to that room with Masa Saito and Inoki, just telling me, listen, I want you to punch me right in the face just as hard as you can. He said, don't knock me out, but if you break my nose, if you cut my lip, you know, hit me in the stomach, pick me up. And I was still pretty green, and I really hadn't perfected my assault, I guess is what I'd call it, you know. But I did a pretty good job of it, and I beat him in about four minutes. And these Japanese people, they got madder than hell. You know, they sit on pillows in the Sumo Palace. They lit their pillows on fire and was throwing them. And next thing I know, I'm being rushed out of the building into the locker room and said, well, no, you got to leave. You got to get the hell out of here because they'll be back in this locker room here in a few minutes.
Now, when you say that the crowd's sitting on pillows, I'm thinking, okay, well, they can't do any damage with those things because they're not steel or wooden chairs. But you just said they lit them on fire and thrown those things in the ring. Is that a shoot?
Yeah, that was a shoot, buddy.
Jesus Christ. So you guys end up getting banned from the building, right?
Yeah, we got banned from the building for, God, I think it was 2 or 3 years.
So where'd y'all perform after that?
Well, there's a number of stadiums. I mean, Sumo Palace was a good arena, and it held, I don't know, 20,000, 25,000.
Now, okay, now are they mad because he lost, or is it heat directly on you because you just beat the shit out of him?
Well, you know, after the match, they had told me to keep on him, and in other words, he was laying there, you know, kind of knocked out from the finish and the damage I had done. He was laying on the floor, and they told me to go over there and pick him up and set him up in the corner and give him a few more punches. And then the ring filled up with, you know, all the young boys and 10 of them. And, you know, I told him just to, you know, don't crowd me, feed me one at a time. And I beat up 10 guys, and then they got mad at me. And then so the heat was directed at me and, you know, the fact that their hero had lost and got treated in that fashion. So it was a heck of a first night, let me put it that way.
Probably one of the greatest first nights in the history of the business, if not the – well, that's got to go down as hands down the greatest debut in the history of the business.
I don't know about that, but, man, it sure must be one of them, because I tell you what.
Dave sure made an impact. I mean, that set the tone right there. You came in and were physical and got over, and that's what it's all about.
You know what, they were doing very well. They were doing good business, and they were, the BABA was a company, the All Japan Pro Wrestling, that was about 50-50 with top Americans, Brody and Hansen and Hardy Race and DiBiase and Snuka and the Ortons and the Funks. And so they had a lot of big names on the other side, and Inoki had went the other direction. He was using... Until that debut, he was primarily using Japanese folks. And I think he saw his business slowly dropping off because BABA, you know, was bringing in that diversity. So with me, it kind of started, and then we had 2 or 3 Americans a trip, and then 3 or 4, and it eventually grew up to those 5 or 6 Americans on each trip. And business picked up because from that night, Steve, we sold out about, I don't want to exaggerate this, but I think close to 4 years every night from that night. It was just sold out wherever we went.
And, you know, man, that reminds me, Leon, of because I went to New Japan on 1 or 2 trips through WCW. And it was almost like shades of the competition between those two companies, New Japan and All Japan. I mean, it was a real deal. I mean, it was total competition. It reminded me of the Monday Night Wars between WCW and WWF that would come way, way down the road. But I mean, it was heavy duty comp. Did you guys ever mix when the promotions crossed paths?
You know what, Steve? Not until we did a Tokyo Dome, and I don't know. I can't really remember the number. There was 75, 85, maybe 90,000 people there, and that was a cross promotion. All Japan had their folks there. Chinru was there. There were four main events, and Stan and Hansen and myself were one of them. Stan was the world champion for Baba, All Japan Pro Wrestling, and I was the world champion for Inoki, New Japan Pro Wrestling. And I don't know if I'm getting ahead of myself here, if you wanted to get into this right now, but
jump on it. This we're here.
Okay, well, this is that infamous, you know, eye match where, you know, Stan had thumbed me in the eye and my eye popped out of my cheek. Stan got introduced first, and then, you know, in Japan, that simply wasn't a big idea. That wasn't a big deal, who got introduced first or who got introduced second. But, you know, it still had a little meaning to it. And the fact, I didn't know what was going to happen before, and Stan got introduced first, and I came out second. And the powers that be of New Japan had told me to get in the ring with that helmet and blow the smoke off. Set it down, do your ceremony. I did a little ceremony, got down on one knee, and blew the smoke up. And I said, guys, that ain't going to work. Stan ain't going to let me do that. He's going to kick the shit out of that mask and start wrestling. I know Stan. I've been around him. And, you know, those helmets are expensive, and they break easy. And those engine, you know, the engine that blew out the smoke was expensive. And I said, it'd be better if I just walked out of it and left it on the side of the ring and had one of the young boys bring it back. And they, no, that's what we want you to do, and this is the way it is. So, yes, sir. So I got that helmet on, and I get to the side of the ring, and I take it off and put my fist up in the helmet and start to get up in the ring. And it's you know, you've got them little steps, and it's dark, and it's kind of a little bit awkward getting in the ring and negotiating the steps. And so I'm kind of nursemaid it up there, the steps, and I got the mask in one hand, and I'm looking for that top rope to grab it so I could get through and negotiate my way in. And Stan came over with that bull rope, and he's swinging it, and in the middle, Stan can't see very good when his glasses are off. And it was dark. The ring was all lit up, and it was dark outside of there. So I'm not, you know, he didn't mean to do it, but it happened. And he hit me with that bull rope and had that big old cowbell on it, and that thing was solid steel. And he hit me right in the face. It was kind of in the left side of the nose and the eye. Boy, it hurt like hell. I mean, it knocked me cold. I got back down. I jumped off the ring and landed on the ground, set that mask down like I should have done in the first place, and I just stood there. I couldn't move, and I didn't think I'd be able to continue, because I opened my eyes and I couldn't see nothing, and I could hear, but I couldn't see. So he whacked me good one. So I took a couple deep breaths, and then finally it's kind of like a boxer coming out of that little box they get into when they get hit real good.
Yep.
So I got back in the ring, and I was madder than hell. And Stan didn't know he'd hit me. You know, the first
God damn, was he that big old blind?
Because
I've heard this about him years and years and years. He can't see. But what you didn't say when he hit you with that cowbell was it broke your damn nose. So you're hotter than a sumbitch.
Yeah, my nose was broken. And
you don't know why he hit you. You don't know why he blasted you in the face with the cowbell. You're just trying to do your thing. Well, you know he's going to do his gimmick. He doesn't know he's blasted you in the face. And so you're about to get in the ring. You've regained your composure. And now Big Van Vader's a little ticked off, to put it mildly.
But yeah, and you got to realize this is Stan Hansen in Japan.
Oh, I got it, brother. All-time, God status.
God status. I mean, and still is to this day.
Yes.
I mean, this is Stan Hansen. He's the heavyweight champion of the world for All Japan.
And that means something. That's a shoot. I mean, it's a work, but that's a shoot.
Buddy, he could move over to Japan today and make a great living just making personal appearances.
Yeah.
He speaks enough Japanese, he could do that. He's got godlike status over there. But like I said, I got madder than hell, and you know, Stan's never been treated like this in the ring, so I kind of walked in the ring. He still had his cowboy hat on, and boy, I took my right hand, and it was taped up and had that big old glove on it, so when I slapped him in the side of the head just as hard as I could. And I think I about knocked him out, because he staggered over in the corner, and boy, the fight was on. And I had him in that corner, and I was cussing at him and punching him and saying, what the hell did you hit me in the face with that bell for? Because you're talking about crippling me. You're not talking about, you know, being stiff, or
yeah.
You're talking about putting an eye out or knocking me out or You know, and if you can't see, why in the hell were you swinging it? You know, it was crazy, and I was mad, and so I was laying him in there, and I caught him with a good one. And I buckled his knees, and he gave me two quick lefts.
Yep.
And the first one caught me in the eye, and it had his thumb out, and he thumbed me in the eye once, and he thumbed me in the eye a second time, and my eye popped out of my cheek, and I tucked my eye in and wrestled 27 more minutes. But it's just something within you, and that was in me at that moment that. It didn't cross my mind to quit, and what I should—I had my eye was hanging on my cheek, and I should have quit. Took off my mask, showed everybody my eye was hanging out there on my cheek, and you know what? No, there would have been no shame, and you know the night would have went on. But I shoved that sucker back in, and
Jesus.
The swelling swelled over and held it in there. So now my nose is completely broke. Every bone in my eye orbit's broke. My face is on fire. I'm in a lot of pain. Worried about my eye. And, you know, we just went at it. And we fought another. We won a 30-minute draw, and we had one hell of a match, one of the best matches I've ever had. And obviously there was a little tension between Sam and I after that. You know, I smacked him in the head. He poked my eye out. But I consider him a friend today. And you know what? When later on in my career, from New Japan, I migrated to WCW and then on to the WWE. When it was time for me to leave the WWE, it was Stan that called me and asked me to be his tag team partner. So, you know, there's no hard feelings, and I don't got a bad word to say about it. I mean, it was an unfortunate thing that happened, and maybe some bad judgment used on both sides, but it just turns out to be one hell of a wrestling story, and it was true.
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, when I watch that match back, I mean, there it was obviously about a physical of matches I've ever seen. I mean, it looked like two McHuffin bulls just going at it nonstop. And you don't see a whole lot of communication. I mean, and you guys were obviously good at what you did, but I mean, it was a goddamn brawl. I mean, and you guys, it was just well executed. And especially with the tempers flaring like they were, you know, I couldn't see you cussing him out, or it was just, I don't know, it was two badass pros that looked like bulls in there giving it hell. So it was a hell of a damn match. What was the surgery to correct your eyesight, and did you suffer permanent vision damage from that? How long were you out of the ring at that point after that match?
You know what, I don't think a whole long, but I got the eye put back in socket in the right place, and that was the first surgery. But I looked to the left, and that right eye, it wouldn't look to the left. In other words, it would lag. So my left eye would be looking to the left, and the right eye would be looking straight ahead.
Right.
And what had happened was that cord that attaches to your eye had been stretched, so they had to go back in and cut it and make it. They had to move my eyes when I was out and make sure that eye was moving in coordination with the other eye. So it was not just a matter of snipping a little off. It was how much to snip off.
God damn, that's kind of like going to getting your damn front end aligned. You're getting your goddamn eyes aligned.
And then they had what they did is the whole right side of that nose was crushed, and they just put a piece of steel in each nostril. My nasal passages are steel, and well, my nose hadn't been broke since then, so I guess that's working. And then they mended the eye orb because it was broken eight places, and they cemented that all up. And so I think it was like three surgeries in total, and got that eye back in place. And can I flip the script here on you? When you got hurt, when you got paralyzed, and when you were laying there on your back, I mean, your whole body went numb. You had no feeling in your whole body, right?
No, I couldn't move a damn thing. I was just laying there looking up at the lights, and the first thing I thought, well, I knew I was thinking immediately, you know, Christopher Reed had just got thrown off that horse, you know, some while earlier and turned into a quadriplegic, you know, from Superman fame and a class act. And I was sitting there, I straight up, shoot, I was laying there looking at the lights thinking, I'm Christopher Reeve. And I told Owen, I said, don't touch me, I can't move. And so, you know, that's when he started buying the time, because the stipulation was if I lost that match, I was going to have to kiss his ass. So I'm thinking on my back, I've got to get out of this match. I've got to get out of this match. But I can't move because I'm paralyzed. I was a transient quadriplegic, because the terminology for that, getting dropped on your head is an axial load. You come from a football background. You know, just like I do, man, when you go to hit somebody and you have your head down, That's the number one cause of quadriplegics in athletics or a car crash or whatever. Not a whiplash. It's that axial load, which I had suffered. And then finally, I started getting my feeling back, and I turned over onto my stomach, and I made that audible to Earl. I said, tell him roll up for the win, because I was supposed to go over with the Stone Cold Stunner. That's what the crowd there in Jersey had come to see, to get me to get that Intercontinental title back. And so I couldn't use my hands yet, so I couldn't crawl on my hands. I could only use my forearms. My shoulders were on fire. If you watch that tape back, see, it's worked for me even to make my legs bend and to start crawling. It was the worst roll-up in the history of the business. But all I knew was, I'm a pro wrestler, something's gone wrong in a match, but I must finish the sumbitch and get out of Dodge. So I had to call that audible and to continue the best I could, which is probably, you know, the worst thing that I could have done. But me being Stone Cold Steve Austin, the toughest SOB in the WWF, I couldn't lay there and look at the lights and let them stretcher me out of that sumbitch. So I called an audible to finish that damn match. But going back to your mentality, or the old story when Dr. Death got busted and had, I don't know, 100 stitches in his face and showed up to work that next day. So, or to Triple H when he tore his quad in a tag match with me and kept going to finish the match. You know, you do what you got to do to finish the match. Me, because I'm so, well, don't get me wrong, being paralyzed there for about 60 seconds wasn't fun. But boy, when you think about your vision and you have all your faculties about you and you think, well, I can make a real conscious decision, just walk out of here and everything's okay because it's my eye. You said, fuck that. You shoved your eye back in and continued to beat the shit out of each other. So, you know, a hellacious day at the office and a totally different mindset. I mean, and that's the mindset. I think it still exists today to a large degree, but it has certainly been lost on a few guys.
Yeah, but Steve, it's for me, I mean, you know, my eye is one thing, and you lose the sight of your eye, that would be tragic. But your situation was a whole different kettle of fish, buddy, and it was the most impressive thing I'd ever seen in the ring, because I, for some reason, I realized I was in a position, I saw your head hit and bend forward like that, and I saw your body just go limp, and I instantly knew that you weren't just in trouble, you were in serious imminent danger. And what you did after that was the most impressive thing I'd ever seen in the ring. And forget all the moves and all the mic work you did. I mean, that right there to me was the most impressive thing I'd ever seen you do or any wrestler do in the ring. And I'm not here to kiss your ass or put you over, but that's a shoot.
Man, sometimes you know how it is, Leon. You get out there and some days are tougher than others. And obviously that was a tough day in the office for you against Stan Hansen, myself there.
Yeah.
You know, laying in the ring there in New Jersey at Meadowlands Arena, not knowing whether to shut or wind my watch and get myself out of a jam. But anyway, Leon, one of the things I wanted to ask you, I know when we were talking earlier, you were talking about how the Vader gimmick was created, but what was your thoughts when they showed you this big mask that you would wear to the ring? And did they have to fit that to you, custom fit? And just what was your thoughts in general when you, because I thought that damn mask was the coolest thing I'd ever seen when I first saw it on television. What were your thoughts when you first saw it?
But I liked it. I didn't really know what it was, but they told me it was similar to what a samurai warrior used to wear, you know, back in the day. And it was a shoot replication. It had the shoulder pads, the chest protection, and obviously this had some modifications to it simply because, you know, you had that engine in the back, and it was a pretty complicated engine. It held two oxygen tanks that blew out the steam, and the eyes lit up, and literally they had a microphone in there, a wireless mic, where I could talk to the people over the intercom system in the arena. So the original piece of that was really expensive and quite intricate. I mean, I love the fact that it not only the eyes lit up and not only could you talk, but it was as if it was a character in itself. It was alive. It wasn't an inanimate object. It did stuff. You know, it was kind of like a moving little robot toy.
Now, how'd they get this thing from building to building? Did they just put this on the ring truck? Because obviously it's a little too much for you to pack around and just throw in a suitcase.
Yeah, you know what? In Japan, they toted it around for me. They'd take it out of the box, make sure it was working, and they'd put it on my head. I'd walk out to the ring, and they'd take it, and I wouldn't see it again. Anoki had given me another one, said, take it home with you, and you can have this one forever. This one's yours. And I started out doing some indies with it, and had it, which is WCW, brought it to a few of those matches, but it just turned out to be just an impossible task. You know, you had to pay $150 extra baggage for it.
You still have it? So,
yeah, I still got it here. I bring it occasionally to some autograph sessions, you know, when you know, you get things set up for the promoter. And
what does that thing weigh?
You know, without the engine and without all the, it don't weigh but, you know, 10 or 15 pounds. It is nothing. It's well-constructed fiberglass, but that engine and with the oxygen tanks in it, it was pretty heavy. It was, you know, 55, 60 pounds, you know.
How was your vision once you put that thing on?
Well, that's dead. you know, you could see straight. You couldn't see the left or right, up or down, or obviously you couldn't see behind you, but you couldn't see nothing. And I tell you what, there's no barriers in Japan. And those, you know, these little 12, 13-year-old kids, and everyone over there is in the mixed martial arts, and boy, they'd come over and they'd kick you in the knee. They'd get behind you and kick you in the back of the knee, in the back of the leg, and they disliked that character. And you know, and wearing that helmet on and getting surrounded like that. And they had security. They had six or seven people around me, but those kids would get right by those guys and they would kick me and hit me. And they had those sticks with the chain on them. And
yeah,
they'd
like
hit you with that. Yeah, man, I'll tell you what. It was an adventure just getting to the ring, you know?
Hey, were there ever any malfunctions with the thing? I mean, because like sometimes you'd put that thing in the middle of the ring, you'd point at it and the steam would blow. Did you have any funny stories of any kind of bloopers or hiccups that happened with that thing?
All the time that thing wasn't 100%. It worked most of the time pretty good. I'd probably say 95%. But, you know, you'd set that thing down and, you know, you'd look at the people and you'd look at, you know, get them going. And then people get behind it, it'd get louder and louder. And people going, yeah, you know. And I think I said something like the Gumbati, which meant basically it means I'll do my best. In other words, I'll fight my ass off for you. And it's a fight chant, you know. I'll fight to the death or something like that. You say Gumbati, then you'd go, Vader, and you'd point at that thing and nothing would happen. they would laugh their ass off, and then I'd turn my back and walk away from it, you know, and I kind of like I had a relation to it. I'd kind of take my hand and go, you know, like, you know, I'm disgusted with it, you know, and turn around, and then the smoke would come up and they'd laugh again. So if it didn't work, we'd try to pull off that secondary routine where, you know, I'd get mad at it and walk away from it. And like, I wouldn't flip it off, but kind of that's what the gesture meant. It was like, hey, fuck you. You didn't blow your smoke for me. I'd turn my back on it, and then he'd hit it again, and it would work most of the time that second time. And, boy, they'd get a kick out of that. So,
Leon, over there in Japan, you were the IWGP heavyweight champion four times. Now, and some of these were wins were in tournament fashion, right? Where you wrestled three or four times in a single night?
Yeah, at times we had tournaments like that. The tag team tournaments were like that. And then there was a group called the UWFI, and the head of that group was a guy named Nobu Takada. And what he did was he created a tournament, and what he did is signed up shoot fighters, mixed martial arts fighters, karate guys, judo guys, amateur wrestlers. Viktor Hasharmikov was there. He's two-time gold medalist from Russia. And let me tell you what, this guy, he didn't understand much about working. Let me tell you, he was 5'10", 5'11", maybe 6 foot, and 345 pounds. And, you know, you're talking about a Russian with a legit two-time gold medalist. So you hated wrestling him because I don't care how big and how strong he was. If he got a hold of you, you know, you were going down.
Right,
you're going to that. There wasn't much you could do. I don't care how many weights you lifted or how tough you were, unless you had some brass knuckles and caught him right in the forehead coming in, he was going to get a hold of you and take you down. So, you know, so one night you're getting karate, the next night you're fighting a shoot fighter, and the next night you're fighting Viktor Hasharmikov. So, I don't know what possessed me to join that tournament because I was the heavyweight champion at the WCW. And they actually flew over to the office and, Bill Watts was the promoter. And he said, Leon, they're offering you a lot of money to do this tournament. But, I mean, you looked at this roster they're talking about, you know, you fighting. And anyways, I got into the thing. And, well, I'll tell you what, there was some moments in time there where I wish, you know, the deal was that my contract with WCW, they allowed me time off to do matches in Japan.
Right.
So I'd fly over there and do a match and come back and fly right back to Atlanta and then start working again. And there were some tough nights, let me tell you. But I ended up winning that tournament, and they were gunning for me. I mean, everybody wanted, you know, win, lose, or draw. They wanted to, you know, they wanted me to look bad. Because pretty much, here's how the, you know, before the match, you wouldn't call anything. It was just, hey, whatever happens, happens. And then when the referee says go home, then you'd go ahead and do your finish.
Hey, out of all the Japanese wrestlers you faced in the many years that you spent over there with different companies, who were some of your toughest opponents?
Inoki, just being the man he was and in his position, and legitimately a tough guy, very, very talented at striking, and knew every submission hold in the business. I mean, he could break your ankle in a minute. So Inoki was a tough son of a gun. And so there was a guy named Mitsuharu Mizawa.
Yes.
And he, this cat, man, I'll tell you what, he was 6'1", and he was probably one of the most talented wrestlers I've ever been in the ring with, Steve. He was just incredible. He knew every hold, every submission, could come off the top rope. He had the American style down. He had the Japanese style down. And I think he would have been a big star.
Okay, stop right there, Leon. Okay, the American style versus the Japanese style. Define the two. What's the difference?
First of all, from an individual standpoint, the talent, the major talent, guys like Chono and Muta and Inoki and Choshu and Mizawa and Akiyama and Kobashi, Tenryu and all the big names, Jumbo Tsuruta, all these big names, these guys were not just good, they were excellent. I mean, in my mind, a lot of these guys I just named off are Hall of Fame caliber, without question. And, you know, I mean, physically, was there anybody ever more talented in the ring, physically talented, physically gifted, than Muta in his prime?
Right.
You know, I remember the first time wrestling him, and he's a legit 6'2", 6'2 and a half, and, you know, big kid, 240 pounds, 250 pounds, and could do anything. Physically anything, you know, and has all that discipline and all those Japanese submission holds and conditioning that goes along with being a Japanese wrestler. So, you know, I think there's pound for pound, wrestler for wrestler, that it would be hard to say that, you know, that the Japanese wrestlers were less skilled or not as good as us, the American wrestlers, but they just simply didn't have the physicality in terms of size and strength to compete with us. Because guys like Stan Hansen and guys like Brody, you know, regardless of how good you are, I mean, Brody is 6'5" and 340 pounds. He's going to kick the shit out of you, and that's the bottom line.
But they did work a strong style over there, much more stiff or snug than American style.
Yeah, and again,
across the board.
Across the board, you bet, Steve. And that, you know, goes back to my stories. You know, shit, Steve, I had a hell of a run in Japan, you know, from New Japan to All Japan to that shoe group to NOAH, all four companies. You know, I had a great deal of success, and we drew big money and big crowds, and it was an adventure, to say the least.
But so when you were working over in New Japan, you're working New Japan, and then all of a sudden you start making shots for WCW, all of a sudden they say, hey, we want you here full time. So you sign up with WCW, and who was running Dusty was booking at the time.
Yeah, Dusty was booking at the time.
Okay, and he brings you in and says, what, go get over?
Here's the deal. Now, here's where two things happened to me in the WCW, because I came over there, and just out of, you know, common sense, I realized that, you know, this isn't Japan, this isn't Europe, this isn't Mexico. You know, you had to tone it down. So I was working what I thought, in my mind, was, you know, half of the type of aggression that I would have used in a typical match in Japan. And I guess we're talking about being stiff or unstiff, or just being aggressive and doing things that the American crowds weren't used to seeing. And I cut it down in half, and then I was blessed by two things, a guy named Sting, Steve Bork. And Steve is, without question, one of the greatest wrestlers in the history of the sport. Steve sat me down and talked to me, and, you know, and said, I know what you're used to. You know, we've had that first match together, and, you know, we got good chemistry, and the crowd liked it, and, you know, he knew what was going on before anybody, and basically said, you know, you don't have to. He said, I'm going to be there for you. You don't have to do this, and you don't have to do this, and you don't have to knock me out, and I'm going to be there for you.
Right.
And I owe a lot to Steve, because what he did for me is, you know, he slowed me down and realized I could get over and do things, do a lot less and get a lot more out of it. And yet, person to what everyone else was doing, I was still perceived as that, you know, that big aggressive monster. And so I thought it, you know, my time in the WCW was productive and worked well, and, you know, had a hell of a run down there. The other blessing for me, of course, was Harley Race, and the one and only Harley Race, the great Harley Race. And, you know, talk about having an encyclopedia of wrestling knowledge in your corner every night, and then, you know, traveling down the road with him. And Harley had a great deal to do with the success of that team, Big Van Vader and Harley Race. And, you know, my hat's off to him, because Harley was the type of guy, he wouldn't say, you know, in terms of advice to me as my manager in the ring, he wouldn't say nothing unless I asked for it. If I asked for it, he'd give it. And, boy, I'll tell you what, it was a real blessing. Those two things, to be hooked up with Sting right away and learn the American style and learn how to, you know, get through the ring without pissing someone off because you're a little too aggressive or you're too stiff or something like that. And then having Harley's type of wisdom and knowledge and experience behind you and with you, it just was a tremendous blessing for me and the character Vader in WCW.
Well, going back to Singer for a second, when you first came in and you guys started working together, did y'all sit down? I mean, before you guys even touched, or was it after that first endeavor when it was pretty damn snug? And you guys had tremendous chemistry. I mean, it just seemed like you guys were peanut butter and jelly out there. And man, that guy, you were pretty gentle. That being said, you're gentle and still getting, you know, pretty mauled. And it just never, ever, to me, seemed like he pissed or moaned or did anything. And always, you know, pulled his end of the wagon just as much as you did, and just was the perfect opponent for Big Van Vader.
You know, Steve, just again, I mean, me starting out with another wrestler, I don't know. You know, I got to take my hat off to Dusty Rhodes. Dusty's a talented man. He allowed me the freedom in the ring to do, you know, what I thought was best. And again, Dusty would coach me from time to time about in-ring work. But really on the mic, I mean, he would sit there and talk to me. And he has a way of communicating through that. For me, it was a combination of you know, Harley Race and Dusty Rhodes and Sting for me to have the success and, you know, the run I had down there at the WCW. But Sting was patient with me. He was obviously an extremely tough individual, and every now he'd catch a shot. I'd catch a shot on him, and you know, he said he caught me pretty good on that one, but that's okay. The rest of the match was good. And, you know, he said, Leon, did you hear a difference, the cheers between that that potato you gave me or the other times? And I said, no. And
so, whose idea was it to put you and Harley together? Did Dusty come to you out of the blue and say, hey, we'd like for you to have a manager? Or was it your idea?
You know, Harley was actually wrestling when I first started doing shots. I was full-time for New Japan and came back, and I forget how it happened, but I got contacted, would you like to do a shot for the WCW? And I think my first appearance was at a pay-per-view with Tom Zink. So I brought that mask out there and blew the smoke, and, you know, thank God everything worked out well, that everything worked just right that first time. And Tom and I went out there, and it was pretty much, you know, 6-7 minute squash match. But Tom put me over big time.
Man, that dude had a great physique, good-looking guy. He could work his ass off.
Yeah, he really could. And I caught him in a crossbody. He came off the rope, cross-bodied me, and I took him from that crossbody, had him about chest high, and I threw him up over my head and pressed him a couple times. And from that point on, it was like, well, you know, how many shots can you give me? We know you're full-time with Anoki, but Dusty was saying, well, can you work this date? Can you work that date? Can you work this date? Can you work from here to here? And the good thing about Japan is you'd go over there and work 5 weeks straight, but you'd come home for, you know, a month and a half. So you'd have plenty of time to do both. And that's where it started for me with the WCW was Tom Zink. And again, I just can't say enough about Sting and what he did for me.
You guys are riding down the road. You and Harley Race, he's an 8-time world champion, and he never would give you any advice unless you asked for it. But what would the advice consist of? Slow down, grab a hold. Certainly didn't have to tell you to be more aggressive. You weren't necessarily a guy who cheated behind the referee's back. So in what ways was Harley able to help you up your game, or any kind of advice that he would give you? What would it consist of?
He had great spots. He would see a situation and say, well, now what if you would have done this? and then this, instead of doing what you did, which was this and this. He said, you see how that would have fit.
Right.
And he said, you know, a hold right there in this point. He said, you know, you, it seems like you're almost afraid to grab a hold. You know, you're a big guy and you don't, you know, change the pace. You're just, you're shitting and getting the whole match.
Right.
He was more flexible in terms of psychology, you know, and the thing you just said, slow down, you know, every now and then, if you feel like you're, I think one of the things that stuck with me the most that he taught me was, you know, if you think you're going too slow, slow down.
Right.
And that hit home with me because it worked every time.
There's never a dull week in the world of professional wrestling. So to keep up on all of it, be sure to subscribe to the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast here at Podcast One. I produce two new shows each week. Every Thursday on our flagship show, I'm joined by a co-host from the wrestling journalism field to talk about the hot topics in WWE and elsewhere. Every Friday, I'm joined by a guest who has worked in the wrestling business, including ex-WWE creative team members like Kevin Eck talking about Drew McIntyre.
Drew was a young guy, and did it go to his head, and did he walk around like he was the chosen one? He did, and I was frank with him, and I said, Drew, just so you know, this is how they view you.
And Podcast One's own Christian Harloff, talking about his days working for WWE, and Vince McMahon specifically.
As far as their perception of him, I mean, he's the king. He walks in, and it's just, you can feel it. I mean, if the force was real, you would feel the force powering into the room when he enters.
Just search Wade Keller on Apple Podcasts or on the Podcast One app or anywhere else you listen to podcasts.
All right, everybody, give me the go-home cue. It's time to wrap up this podcast and ride off in the sunset. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Leon White, also known as Big Van Vader or Vader, a guy who brought that gimmick to life and absolutely terrorized the inside of a squared circle. What a physical force he was. I loved watching his matches. Probably my favorite matches he had were with Sting. And he had some good ones with Ric Flair, but I loved his matchups with Sting because they just really seemed to complement each other with the skill set and move set that they employed and that fire that Sting had back in the day. He was such a force, you know, in his WCW days, in those early days, and Leon really brought him to life and vice versa. So they were just great opponents, and I loved watching those matches and traveling down the road with him and Harley Race, listening to stories and shooting the breeze with those guys was a real honor, and I had so much fun knowing Leon. I know we'll all miss him, and the pro wrestling world will miss, you know, all the contributions that he made to the business of pro wrestling. Man, a guy was just an unbelievable entertainer and a true badass in the ring, and that's what pro wrestling is all about, his style and the believability and the realness of it all. That was Big Van Vader, and Leon White made that all come to life and made it all happen. Hey, man, ProWrestlingTees.com/Steve Austin has all my T-shirts from Broken Skull Ranch. We're about to come out with some new Nevada edition stuff, so stay tuned for that. And the best damn IPA on the planet, in my opinion, is Broken Skull IPA from El Segundo Brewing Company. If you live in California, in the Southern California part of the state, you can find it at Whole Foods and Total Wines. Northern California, I'm sorry. I don't think it's being shipped up there. If you cannot get to Southern California, here's one for you. Try BineAndVine.com. That's B-I-N-E and Vine, V-I-N-E.com. BineAndVine.com and see if they ship to a state that you live. And if you're looking for a badass pocket knife, which I recommend everybody have at all times, 24/7, always ready. Cold Steel Broken Skull Knives and myself came up with the Working Man and the Broken Skull. And those are two badass pocket knives at different price points. Always ready. Amazon has the best price on both knives. Just go to amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin or go directly to Cold Steel Knives website and check out all the badass things that they make. And I want to say one more thank you to all the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show, especially DDP Yoga, Buffalo Wild Wings, Geico, TheraWorks, and ADT. That's how I'm able to do this podcast for you twice a week for free. Please support them because they support us. And you can find all my sponsors at podcastone.com under the Killer Deals button at the top of the page. Folks, until next time, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.